Unfortunately, some of the five had lost their heads and killed the old woman. Pat left Richard to choose for himself which rendition he preferred. What she withheld from him was her own. That 9 8-Rocks murdered 5 harmless women, A, because the women were impure, not 8-Rock, B, because the women were unholy, fornicators at the least, abortionists at most, and C, because they could, which was what being an 8-Rock meant to them, and also what the deal required. Richard didn't believe either of the stories rapidly becoming gospel, and spoke to Simon Carey and Senior Pulliam, who clarified other parts of the tale. But because neither had decided on the meaning of the ending, and therefore had not been able to formulate a credible, sermonizable account of it, they could not assuage Richard's dissatisfaction. It was Lone who provided him with the livid details that several people were quick to discredit, because Lone, they said, was not reliable. Except for her, no one overheard the men at the oven, and who knew what they really said. Like the rest of the witnesses, she arrived after the shots were fired. Besides, she and Dovey could be wrong about whether the two women in the house were dead or just wounded. And finally, she didn't see anybody outside the house, living or dead. As for Lone, she became unhinged by the way the story was being retold, how people were changing it to make themselves look good. Other than Deacon Morgan, who had nothing to say, every one of the assaulting men had a different tale, and their families and friends, who had been nowhere near the convent, supported them, enhancing, recasting, inventing misinformation. Although the Duprés, Beauchamp, Sands, and Pools backed up her version, even their reputation for precision and integrity could not prevent altered truth from taking hold in other quarters. If there were no victims, the story of the crime was play for anybody's tongue. So Lone shut up and kept what she felt certain of folded in her brain. God had given Ruby a second chance, had made himself so visible and unarguable a presence that even the outrageously prideful like Stewart and the uncorrectably stupid like his lying nephew ought to be able to see it. He had actually swept up and received his servants in broad daylight, for goodness sake, right before their very eyes, for Christ's sake. Since they were accusing her of lying, she decided to keep quiet and watch the hand of God work the disbelievers and the false witnesses. Would they know they'd been spoken to? Or would they drift further from his ways? One thing for sure, they could see the oven. They couldn't misread or misspeak that, so they had better hurry up and fix its slide before it was too late, which it might already be, for the young people had changed its words again. No longer were they calling themselves "Be the furrow of his brow." The graffiti on the hood of the oven now was, "We are the furrow of his brow." However sharp the divisions about what really took place, Pat knew the big and agreed upon fact was that everyone who had been there left the premises certain that lawmen would be happily swarming all over town. They'd killed a white woman, after all, arresting virtually all of Ruby's businessmen. When they learned there were no dead to report, transport, or bury, relief was so great they began to forget what they'd actually done or seen. Had it not been for Luther, Beauchamp, who told the most damning story, and Pius, Deed Sands, and Aaron, who corroborated much of Lone's version, the whole thing might have been sanitized out of existence. Yet even they could not bring themselves to report unnatural deaths in a house with no bodies, which might lead to the discovery of natural deaths in an automobile full of bodies. Though not privy to many people's confidence, Pat gathered from talks with her father, with Kate, and from deliberate eavesdropping that 4 months later, they were still chewing the problem, asking God for guidance, if they were wrong, if white law should, contrary to everything they knew and believed, be permitted to deal with matters heretofore handled among and by them. The difficulties churned and entangled everybody. Distribution of blame, prayers for understanding and forgiveness, arrogant self-defense, outright lies, and a host of unanswered questions that Richard Meisner kept putting to them. So the funeral came as a pause, but not a conclusion. Maybe they were right about this place all along, Pat thought, surveying the townspeople. Maybe Ruby is lucky. No, she corrected herself. Although the evidence of the assault was invisible, the consequences were not. There was Jeff, his arm around his wife, both looking properly sorrowful, but slightly majestic too, for Jeff was now sole owner of his father's furniture and appliance store. Arnold, suddenly a very old man, with a persistent headache and enjoying his own bedroom now that Arnett had moved out, stood with bowed head and roaming eyes that traveled everywhere but near the coffin. Sergeant Person looked as smug as ever. He had no landlord expecting a field fee, and unless and until the county auditor got interested in a tiny hamlet of quiet, God-fearing black folk, his avarice would go unabated. Harper Jury, uncontrite, was wearing a dark blue suit and a head wound that, like a medal, gave him leave to assume the position of bloodied but unbowed warrior against evil. Menace was the most unfortunate. He had no customers at Anna's anymore, in part because his ruined shoulder restricted his facility with barber tools, but also because his drinking had extended itself to many more days of the week. His dissipation was rapidly coming to its own conclusion. Wisdom Pool had the toughest row to hoe. 70 family members held him accountable, just as they had his brothers, Brood and Apollo, for scandalizing their forefathers' reputations, giving him no peace or status, reprimanding him daily until he fell on his knees and wept before the entire congregation of Holy Redeemer. After testifying, recommitted, renewed, and full of remorse, he began tentative conversations with Brood and Apollo. Arnett and K.D. were building a new house on Stewart's property. She was pregnant again, and they both hoped to get in a position to make life unpleasant for the Pools, the Duprés, the Sands, and the Beauchamps, especially Luther, who took every opportunity to insult K.D. The most interesting development was with the Morgan brothers. Their distinguishing features were eroding, tobacco choices, they gave up cigar and chaw at the same time, shoes, clothes, facial hair. Pat thought they looked more alike than they probably had at birth, but the inside difference was too deep for anyone to miss. Stewart, insolent and unapologetic, took KD under his wing, concentrating on making the nephew and the 16-month-old grandnephew rich, thus the new house, easing KD into the bank while waiting for Dovey to come around, which she seemed to be doing, because there was an obvious coolness between her and Soane. The sisters disagreed about what happened at the convent. Dovey saw Consolata fall, but maintained she did not see who pulled the trigger. Soane knew and needed to know one thing. It had not been her husband. She had seen his hand moving over to Stewart's in a cautioning, preventing gesture. She saw it, and she said it, over and over again, to anyone who would listen. It was Deacon Morgan who had changed the most. It was as though he had looked in his brother's face and did not like himself anymore. To everyone's surprise, he had formed a friendship, well, a relationship anyway, with somebody other than Stewart, the cause, reason, and basis of which were a mystery. Richard Meisner wasn't talking, so all anyone knew for certain was the barefoot walk that took place in public. It was September then, and still hot, when Deacon Morgan walked towards Central. Chrysanthemums to the right, chrysanthemums to the left of the brick path leading from his imposing White House. He wore his hat, business suit, vest, and a clean white shirt. No shoes, no socks. He entered St. John Street, where he had planted trees 50 feet apart, so great was his optimism 20 years earlier. He turned right on Central. It had been at least a decade since the soles of his shoes, let alone his bare feet, had touched that much concrete. Just past Arnold Fleetwood's house, near the corner of St. Luke, a couple said, "Morning, Deke." He lifted his hand in greeting, his eyes straight ahead. Lily Carey helloed from the porch of her house, near Cross Mark, but he did not turn his head. "Car broke down?" she asked, staring at his feet. At Harper Drury's drugstore on the corner of Central and St. Matthew, he felt, rather than saw, watchful eyes traveling alongside him. He didn't turn to see, nor did he glance through the window of the Morgan Savings and Loan Bank as he approached St. Peter. At Cross Peter, he crossed and made his way to Richard Meisner's house. The last time he was here, 6 years before, he was angry, suspicious, but certain he and his brother would prevail. What he felt now was exotic to a twin, an incompleteness, a muffled solitude, which took away appetite, sleep, and sound. Since July, other people seemed to him to be speaking in whispers or shouting from long distances. Soane watched him, but mercifully did not initiate dangerous dialogue. It was as though she understood that had she done so, what he said to her would draw the life from their life. He might tell her that green springtime had been sapped away, that outside of that loss, she was grand, more beautiful than he believed a woman could be, that her untamable hair framed a face of planes so sharp he wanted to touch, that after she spoke, the smile that followed made the sun look like a fool. He might tell his wife that he thought at first she was speaking to him, "You're back," but he knew now it wasn't so, and that instantly he longed to know what she saw. But Stewart, who saw nothing or everything, stopped them dead, lest they know another realm. Earlier that September morning, he had bathed and dressed carefully, but could not bring himself to cover his feet. He handled the dark socks, the shiny black shoes for a long while, then put them aside. He knocked on the door and removed his hat when the younger man answered. I need to speak to you, Reverend. Come on in. Deacon Morgan had never consulted with or taken into his confidence any man. All of his intimate conversations had been wordless ones with his brother or brandishing ones with male companions. He spoke to his wife in the opaque manner he thought appropriate. None had required him to translate into speech the raw matter he exposed to Reverend Meisner. His words came out like ingots pulled from the fire by an apprentice blacksmith, hot, misshapen, resembling themselves only in their glow. He spoke of a wall in Ravenna, Italy, white in the late afternoon sun, with wine-colored shadows pressing its edge, of two children on a beach offering him a shell formed like an S, how open their faces, how loud the bells, of salt water burning his face on a troop ship, of colored girls in slacks waving from the door of a canning factory. Then he told him of his grandfather, who walked barefoot for 200 miles rather than dance. Richard listened intently, interrupting once to offer cool water. Although he did not understand what Deacon was talking about, he could see that the man's life was uninhabitable. Deacon began to speak of a woman he had used, how he had turned up his nose at her because her loose and easy ways gave him the license to drop and despise her, that while the adultery preyed on him for a short while, very short, his long remorse was at having become what the old fathers cursed, the kind of man who set himself up to judge, rout, and even destroy the needy, the defenseless, the different. Who is this woman? Richard asked him. Deacon did not answer. He ran his finger around the inside of his short collar, then started on another story. It seemed his grandfather, Zachariah, was subject to personal taunts as well as newspaper articles describing his malfeasance in office. He was an embarrassment to Negroes and both a threat and a joke to whites. No one, black or white, could or would help him find other work. He was even passed up for a teaching job at a poor country primary school. The Negroes in a position to help were few. The Depression of 73 was severe. But they took Zachariah's dignified manner for coldness and his studied speech for arrogance, mockery, or both. The family lost the nice house and were living, all nine of them, with the sister's family. Mindy, his wife, found work sewing at home, and the children did odd jobs. Few knew, and fewer remembered, that Zachariah had a twin, and before he changed his name, they were known as Coffee and Tea. When Coffee got the State House job, Tea seemed as pleased as everybody else. And when his brother was thrown out of office, he was equally affronted and humiliated. One day, years later, when he and his twin were walking near a saloon, some white men, amused by the double faces, encouraged the brothers to dance. Since the encouragement took the form of a pistol, T, quite reasonably, accommodated the whites, even though he was a grown man, older than they were. Coffee took a bullet in his foot instead. From that moment, they weren't brothers anymore. Coffee began to plan a new life elsewhere. He contacted other men, other former legislators, who had the same misfortune as his, Juvenal Dupre and Drum Blackhorse. They were the three who formed the nucleus of the old fathers. Needless to say, Coffee didn't ask T to join them on their journey to Oklahoma. I always thought coffee, Big Papa, was wrong, said Deacon Morgan. Wrong in what he did to his brother. Tea was his twin, after all. Now I'm less sure. I'm thinking coffee was right, because he saw something in tea that wasn't just going along with some drunken white boys. He saw something that shamed him. The way his brother thought about things, the choices he made went up against it. Coffee couldn't take it, not because he was ashamed of his twin, but because the shame was in himself. It scared him. So he went off and never spoke to his brother again. Not one word, know what I mean? It must have been hard, said Richard. I'm saying he never said another word to him and wouldn't allow anybody else to call his name. Lack of words, Richard said. Lack of forgiveness, lack of love. To lose a brother is a hard thing. To choose to lose one, well, that's worse than the original shame, wouldn't you say? Deacon looked down at his feet for a long time. Richard stayed quiet with him. Finally, he raised his head and said, I've got a long way to go, Reverend. You'll make it, said Richard Meisner. No doubt about it. Richard and Anna doubted the convenient mass disappearance of the victims, and as soon as they got back, went to look for themselves. Other than a sparkling white crib in a bedroom with the word divine taped to the door and foodstuffs, there was nothing recently lived in about the place. The chickens were wilding or half-eaten by four-footed prowlers. Pepper bushes were in full flower, but the rest of the garden was lost. Sergeant's cornfield, the only human touch. Richard barely glanced at the cellar floor. Anna, however, examining it as closely as her lamp permitted, saw the terribleness KD reported. But it wasn't the pornography he had seen, nor was it Satan's scrawl. She saw instead the turbulence of females trying to bridle without being trampled, the monsters that slavered them. They left the house and stood in the yard. Listen, Anna told him. One of them, or maybe more, wasn't dead. Nobody actually looked. They just assumed. Then, between the time folks left and Roger arrived, they got the hell out of there, taking the killed ones with them. Simple, right? Right, said Meisner, but he didn't sound convinced. It's been weeks now, and nobody has come around asking questions. They must not have reported it, so why should we? Whose baby was in there? That crib is new. I don't know, but it sure wasn't Arnett's. He said it again, right, with the same level of doubt. Then, I don't like mysteries. You're a preacher. Your whole life's belief is a mystery. Belief is mysterious. Faith is mysterious. But God is not a mystery. We are. Oh, Richard, she said, as though it was all too much. He had asked her to marry him. Will you marry me, Anna? Oh, I don't know. Why not? Your fire's too stingy. Not when it counts. She had never expected to be that happy. And coming back to Ruby, instead of making the great announcement, they were sorting out what looked like the total collapse of a town. Should we take those chickens? They'll all be eaten anyway. If you want to, he said. I don't. I'll just see if there are any eggs. Anna entered the hen house, wrinkling her nose and stepping through a half inch of chicken litter. She fought a couple of them to get the 5 eggs that she thought were probably fresh. When she came out, both hands full, she called. Richard, got something I can put these in? At the edge of the garden, a faded red chair lay on its side. Beyond was blossom and death, shriveled tomato plants alongside crops of leafy green, reseeding themselves with golden flowers, pink hollyhocks, so tall the heads leaned all the way over a trail of bright squash blossoms, lacy tops of carrots, browned and lifeless, next to straight green spikes of onion. Melons split their readiness, showing gums of juicy red. Anna sighed at the mix of neglect and unconquerable growth, the five eggs warm umber in her hands. Richard came toward her. This big enough? He flicked open his handkerchief. Maybe. Here, hold them while I see if the peppers are out. No, he said, I'll go. He dropped the handkerchief over the eggs. It was when he returned, as they stood near the chair, her hands balancing brown eggs and white cloth, his fingers looking doubled with long pepper pods, green, red, and plum black, that they saw it, or sensed it, rather, for there was nothing to see. A door, she said later. No, a window, he said, laughing. That's the difference between us. You see a door, I see a window. Anna laughed, too. They expanded on the subject. What did a door mean? What a window? Focusing on the sign rather than the event, excited by the invitation rather than the party, they knew it was there, knew it so well, they were transfixed for a long moment before they backed away and ran to the car. The eggs and peppers lay in the rear seat. The air conditioner lifted her collar, and they laughed some more as they drove along, trading pleasant insults about who was a pessimist, who an optimist, who saw a closed door, who saw a raised window. Anything to avoid reliving the shiver or saying out loud what they were wondering, whether through a door needing to be opened or a beckoning window already raised. What would happen if you entered? What would be on the other side? What on earth would it be? What on earth? Reverend Meisner had everyone's attention, and just a few words more to offer. His glance focused on the culpable men, seven of whom, with some primitive instinct for protection, clustered together, away, it seemed, from the other mourners. Sergeant, Harper, Menace, Arnold, Jeff, K.D., Stewart. Wisdom was closest to his own family, and Deacon was not there at all. Richard's thoughts about these men were not generous. Whether they be the first or the last, representing the oldest black families or the newest, the best of the tradition or the most pathetic, they had ended up betraying it all. They think they have outfoxed the white man, when in fact they imitate him. They think they are protecting their wives and children, when in fact they are maiming them. And when the maimed children ask for help, they look elsewhere for the cause. Born out of an old hatred, one that began when one kind of black man scorned another kind, and that kind took the hatred to another level. Their selfishness had trashed 200 years of suffering and triumph in a moment of such pomposity and error and callousness, it froze the mind. Unbridled by scripture, deafened by the roar of its own history, Ruby, it seemed to him, was an unnecessary failure. How exquisitely human was the wish for permanent happiness, and how thin human imagination became trying to achieve it. Soon, Ruby will be like any other country town, the young thinking of elsewhere, the old full of regret. The sermons will be eloquent, but fewer and fewer will pay attention or connect them to everyday life. How can they hold it together, he wondered, this hard-won heaven defined only by the absence of the unsaved, the unworthy, and the strange. Who will protect them from their leaders? Suddenly, Richard Meiser knew he would stay, not only because Anna wanted to, or because Deke Morgan had sought him out for a confession of sorts, but also because there was no better battle to fight, no better place to be than among these outrageously beautiful, flawed, and proud people. Besides, mortality may be new to them, but birth was not. The future panted at the gate. Roger Best will get his gas station, and the connecting roads will be laid. Outsiders will come and go, and some will want a sandwich or a can of 3-2 beer. So who knows? Maybe there will be a diner, too. KD and Stewart will already be discussing TV. It was inappropriate to smile at a funeral, so Meiser envisioned the little girl whose destroyed hands he had once been permitted to hold. It helped him recover his line of thought. The questions he had asked in the mourner's stead needed an answer. May I suggest those are not the important questions, or rather, those are the questions of anguish, but not of intelligence, and God being intelligence itself, generosity itself, has given us mind to know his subtlety, to know his elegance, his purity, to know that what is sown is not alive until it dies. The wind picked up a bit, but not enough to make anyone uncomfortable. Meisner was losing them. They stood before the open grave, closed to everything but their own musings. Funeral thoughts were mingled with plans for Thanksgiving, evaluations of their neighbors, the chitty-chat of daily life. Meisner repressed a sigh before concluding his remarks with prayer. But when he bowed his head and gazed at the coffin lid, he saw the window in the garden, felt it beckon toward another place, neither life nor death, but there, just yonder, shaping thoughts he did not know he had. "Wait, wait," he was shouting. "Do you think this was a short, pitiful life, bereft of worth because it did not parallel your own? Let me tell you something. The love she received was wide and deep, and the care given her was gentle and unrelenting, and that love and care enveloped her so completely that the dreams, the visions she had, the journeys she took, made her life as compelling, as rich, as valuable as any of ours, and probably more blessed. It is our own misfortune if we do not know in our long life what she knew every day of her short one. That although life in life is terminal and life after life is everlasting, he is with us always, in life, after it, and especially in between, lying in wait for us to know the splendor." He stopped, disturbed by what he had said and how. Then, as if to apologize to the little girl, he spoke softly, directly, to her. "Oh, save Marie. Your name always sounded like, save me. Save me. Any other messages hiding in your name? I know one that shines out for all to see. There never was a time when you were not saved, Marie. Amen." His words embarrassed him a little, but on that day, nothing had ever been clearer. Billy Delia walked slowly away from the other mourners. She had stood with her mother and grandfather and smiled encouragingly at Arnett, but now she wanted to be alone. This was her first funeral, and she thought about it in terms of how expansive it made her grandfather to have his skills needed. More on her mind was the absence of the women she had liked. They had treated her so well, had not embarrassed her with sympathy, had just given her sunny kindness. Looking at her bruised face and swollen eyes, they sliced cucumber for her lids after making her drink a glass of wine. No one insisted on hearing what drove her there, but she could tell they would listen if she wanted them to. The one called Mavis was the nicest, and the funniest was Gigi. Billy Delia was perhaps the only one in town who was not puzzled by where the women were or concerned about how they disappeared. She had another question. When will they return? When will they reappear? With blazing eyes, war paint, and huge hands to rip up and stomp down this prison calling itself a town. A town that had tried to ruin her grandfather, succeeded in swallowing her mother, and almost broken her own self. A backward no place ruled by men whose power to control was out of control, and who had the nerve to say who could live and who not and where. Who had seen in lively, free, unarmed females the mutiny of the mayors and so got rid of them. She hoped with all her heart that the women were out there, darkly burnished, biding their time, brass metaling their nails, filing their incisors, but out there, which is to say, she hoped for a miracle. Not so unreasonable a wish, since a mini miracle had already occurred. Brood and Apollo had reconciled, agreeing to wait for her to make up her mind. She knew, as they did, that she never could, and that the threesome would end only when they did. The convent women would roar at that. She could see their pointy teeth. The reprieve took years, but it came. Manly Gibson would die in a ward with others like himself rather than strapped to a chair with no kin looking on. It was a good thing, a great thing. He got to go outside, and now he was part of the work crew at the Lake Road. The lake was so blue, the Kentucky Fried Chicken lunch so fine. Maybe he could run. Some joke. A 52-year-old lifer on the run. Where to? To who? He had been in since 1961, leaving behind an 11-year-old who didn't write anymore, and the only photograph he had of her was when she was 13. Lunchtime was special. They sat near the lake in full sight of the guards, but near the water anyway. Manly wiped his hands on the little paper napkins. To his left, near a couple of trees, a young woman spread two blankets on the grass, a radio in between. Manly turned to see what the crew thought of this. A civilian, and a female too, right in their midst. Armed guards strolled the road above them. None gave sign that they saw her. She turned on the radio and stood up, revealing a face he'd know anywhere. For the life of him, he couldn't help it. Gigi, he hissed. The girl looked his way. Manly, restraining himself, sauntered over to the trees, hoping the guards would think he was taking a leak. Am I right? Is it you? Daddy man? At least she looked pleased to see him. It is you. God damn, I knew it. What you doing here? You knew I was reprieved. No, I didn't know nothing about it. Well, look here. I don't get out or nothing, but I ain't on the row no more. Manly turned to see if others had noticed them. Keep your voice down, he whispered. So what you doing here? he noticed her clothes for the first time. You in the army? Gigi smiled. Sort of. Sort of? You mean you was? Oh, Daddy man, anybody can buy this stuff. Gigi laughed. Give me your address, honey. I'm going to write and tell you everything. Hear from your mother. Her old man's still alive. He was rushing. The lunch whistle was due to sound any minute. I don't have an address yet. Gigi lifted her cap and replaced it. No? Well, you write me, okay? Care of the prison. I'll put you on the list tomorrow. I can get 2 a month. The whistle blew. 2, Manley repeated. Then, say, you still got that locket I give you? I got it. Oh, honey, my little girl. He reached out to touch her, but stopped, saying, I gotta go. They'll demerit me. Care of the prison here? 2 a month. He backed away, still looking at her. Will I hear from you? Gigi straightened her cap. You will, Daddy man. You will. Later, as Manley sat on the bus, he went over every detail of what he had seen of his daughter. Her army cap and fatigue pants, camouflage colors, heavy army boots, black t-shirt, and now that he thought of it, he could swear she was packing. He looked toward the lake, darkening in a lower but prettier sun. Gigi took off her clothes. The nights were chilling the lake, making it harder and harder for the sun to warm it the next day. In this part of the lake, it was okay to swim nude. This was lake country. Viridian water, upright trees, and, in places where no boats or fishermen came, a privacy royals would envy. She picked up a towel and dried her hair. Less than an inch had grown, but she loved how wind and water and fingers and toes rippled in it. She opened a bottle of aloe and began to rub her skin. Then, straightening the towel next to her, she looked toward the lake where her companion was just coming ashore. The 15th painting, like the first, needed more. Trying to remember the chin had frustrated Didi in her first attempt, but when she decided to skip the jawline and just shadow the lower part of her daughter's face, she found the eyes all wrong. Canvas 15 got it better, but still something was missing. The head was fine, but the body, bleak and uninteresting, seemed to need another shape at the hip or elbow. Never having experienced a compulsion that was not sensual, she was puzzled by the energy she could summon at will to freshen or begin the figure anew. The eyes kept coming up accusatory. The skin tone eluded her, and the hair was invariably a hat. Didi sat down on the floor, rolling the brush handle in her fingers while she examined the work she had done. With a long puff of air, she got up and went into the living room. It was when she had taken the first sip of the margarita that she saw her coming across the yard, a knapsack or something tied to her chest. But she had no hair, no hair at all, and a baby's head lay just under her chin. As she came closer, Didi could see 2 fat legs, round as donuts, poking out of the knapsack thing on its mother's chest. She put down the margarita and pressed her face to the picture window. No mistake. It was Palace. 1 hand on the knapsack bottom, the other carrying a sword. A sword? The smile on Palace's face was beatific, and her dress, rose madder and umber, swirled about her ankles with every step. Didi waved and called out her name, or tried to, while she thought Palace, formed it in her mind. It came out different, like then n. Something was wrong with her tongue. Pallas was moving quickly, but not coming toward the front door. She was moving past the house, to the side. Dee Dee, in a panic, ran to the studio, grabbed the 15th canvas, and rushed to the patio, holding it up and shouting, "Ugh! Ugh! Nuh!" Pallas turned, narrowed her eyes, and paused, as if trying to determine where the sound came from. Then, failing, continued on her way. Dee Dee stopped, thinking maybe it was someone else. But with or without hair, that was her face, wasn't it? She, of all people, knew her own daughter's face, didn't she? As well as she knew her own. Dee Dee saw Pallas a second time, in the guest bedroom, where Carlos, the motherfucker, used to sleep. Pallas was searching under the bed as Dee Dee watched, not daring to speak in case the glug sound came out of her mouth. Pallas raised up. With a satisfied grunt, she held aloft a pair of shoes she'd left there on her last and first visit. Huaraches, but expensive leather ones, not that plastic or straw stuff. Pallas didn't turn. She left through the sliding glass door. Dee Dee followed and saw her get into a beat-up car, waiting on the road. Other people were in the car, but the sun was setting, so Dee Dee couldn't tell if they were men or women. They drove off into a violet so ultra it broke her heart. Sally Albright, walking north on Calumet, stopped suddenly in front of the plate glass window of Jenny's Country Inn. She was sure, almost sure, that the woman sitting by herself at a table for four was her mother. Sally moved closer to peep under the woman's straw hat. She couldn't quite see the face, but the fingernails, the hands holding the menu, were indisputable. She went inside the restaurant. A lady near the cash register said, "May I help you?" Every place Sally went now, she gave folks pause, all because of her hair color. "No," she told the lady, "I'm looking for a..." "Oh, there she is," and faking assuredness, sauntered over to the table for four. If she was wrong, she'd say, "Excuse me, I thought you was somebody else." She slipped into a chair and looked closely at the woman's face. "Mom?" Mavis looked up. "Oh my," she said, smiling. "Look at you. I wasn't sure, the hat and all, but God, look, it is you." Mavis laughed. "Oh man, I knew it. God, Mom, it's been years." "I know. Have you eaten?" "Yeah, just finished. I'm on my lunch hour. I work at..." The waitress raised her order pad. "Have you all decided yet?" "Yes," said Mavis. "Orange juice, double grits, and two eggs over medium." "Bacon?" asked the waitress. "No, thanks. We got good sausage, link and patty." "No, thanks. You serve gravy with the biscuits?" "Sure do. Poured or on the side?" "On the side, please." "Sure thing." "And you?" She turned to Sally. "Just coffee." "Oh, come on," said Mavis. "Have something, my treat." "I don't want anything." "You sure?" "Yeah, I'm sure." The waitress left. Mavis lined up the placemat and flatware. "That's what I like about this place. They let you choose. Gravy poured or on the side. See?" "Mom, I don't want to talk about food." Sally felt as though her mother was sliding away, acting like their seeing each other wasn't important. "Well, you never did have much of an appetite." "Where have you been?" "Well, I couldn't come back, could I?" "You mean that warrant stuff?" "I mean everything. How about you? You been all right?" "Mostly. Frankie's fine. Gets all A's. But Billy James ain't so hot." "Oh, why?" "Hangs out with some real scary little shits." "Oh, no. You should go see him, Ma. Talk to him." "I will." "Will you?" Can I have my lunch first? Mavis laughed and removed her hat. Ma, you cut your hair off. There it was again, that slidey feeling. It looks nice, though. How you like mine? Cute. No, it ain't. Thought I'd like blonde tips, but I'm tired of it now. Maybe I'll cut mine, too. The waitress arrived and neatly arranged the plates. Mavis salted her grits and swirled a pat of butter on top. She sipped her orange juice and said, "Ooh, fresh." It came out in a rush because she felt she had to hurry. If she was going to say anything, she had to hurry. I was scared all the time, Ma, all the time, even before the twins. But when you left, it got worse. You don't know. I mean, I was scared to fall asleep. Taste this, honey. Mavis offered her the glass of juice. Sally took a quick swallow. Daddy was, shit, I don't know how you stood it. He'd get drunk and try to bother me, Ma. Oh, baby. I fought him, though. Told him the next time he passed out, I was going to cut his throat open. Would have, too. I'm so sorry, said Mavis. I didn't know what else to do. You were always stronger than me. Did you never think about us? All the time. And I sneaked back to get a peep at you all. No shit, Sally grinned. Where? At the school, mostly. I was too scared to go by the house. You wouldn't know it now. Daddy married a woman who kicks his butt if he don't act right and keep the yard clean and stuff. She packs a gun, too. Mavis laughed. Good for her. But I moved out. Me and Charmaine got us a place together over on Auburn. She's a, you sure you don't want something? It's really good, Sal. Sally picked up a fork, slipped it into her mother's plate, scooping up a buttery dollop of grits. When the fork was in her mouth, their eyes met. Sally felt the nicest thing then, something long and deep and slow and bright. You gonna leave again, Ma? I have to, Sal. You coming back? Sure. But you'll try and talk to Billy James, won't you? And Frankie'd love it. You want my address? I'll talk to Billy and tell Frankie I love him. I'm sick and sorry about everything, Ma. I was just so scared all the time. Me too. They were standing outside. The lunch crowd thickened with shoppers and their kids. Give me a hug, baby. Sally put her arms around her mother's waist and began to cry. Uh-uh, said Mavis, none of that now. Sally squeezed. Ouch, said Mavis, laughing. What? Nothing. That side hurts a bit, that's all. You okay? I'm perfect, Sal. I don't know what you think about me, but I always loved, always, even when... I know that, Sal. Know it now, anyway. Mavis pushed a shank of black and yellow hair behind her daughter's ear and kissed her cheek. Count on me, Sal. See you again, won't I? Bye, Sal. Bye. Sally watched her mother disappear into the crowd. She ran her finger under her nose, then held the cheek that had been kissed. Did she give her the address? Where was she going? Did they pay? When did they pay the cashier? Sally touched her eyelids. One minute they were sopping biscuits. The next, they were kissing in the street. Several years ago, she had checked out the foster home and saw the mother, a cheerful, no-nonsense woman the kids seemed to like. So fine. That was it. Fine. She could go on with her life, and did, until 1966, when her gaze was drawn to girls with huge chocolate eyes. Seneca would be older now, 13 years old, but she checked with Mrs. Greer to see if she had kept in touch. Who are you again? Her cousin, Jean. Well, she was only here for a short while, a few months, really. Do you know where? No, honey, I don't know a thing. After that, she was unexpectedly distracted in malls, theater ticket lines, buses. In 1968, she was certain she spotted her at a Little Richard concert, but the press of the crowd prevented a closer look. Jean was discreet about this subversive search. Jack didn't know she'd had a child before, at 14, and it was after marriage, when she had his child, that she began to search for the eyes. The sightings came at such odd moments and in such strange places. Once she believed the girl climbing out of the back of a pickup truck was her daughter, that when she finally bumped into her in 1976, she wanted to call an ambulance. Jean and Jack were crossing the stadium parking lot under blazing Klieg lights. A girl was standing in front of a car, blood running from her hands. Jean saw the blood first and then the chocolate eyes. "Seneca," she screamed, and ran toward her. As she approached, she was intercepted by another girl who, holding a bottle of beer and a cloth, began to clean away the blood. "Seneca?" Jean shouted over the second girl's head. "Yes? What happened? It's me." "Some glass," said the second girl. "She fell on some glass. I'm taking care of her." "Jean, come on." Jack was several cars down. "Where the hell are you?" "Coming, just a minute, okay?" The girl, wiping Seneca's hands, looked up from time to time to frown at Jean. "Any glass get in?" she asked Seneca. Seneca stroked her palms, first one, then the other. "No, I don't think so." "Jean, traffic's gonna be hell, babe. Don't you remember me?" Seneca looked up, the bright lights turning her eyes black. "Should I? From where?" "On Woodlawn. We used to live in those apartments on Woodlawn." Seneca shook her head. "I lived on Beacon, next to the playground." "But your name is Seneca, right?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'm Jean." "Lady, your old man's calling you." The girlfriend wrung out the cloth and poured the rest of the beer over Seneca's hands. "Ow," Seneca said to her friend. "It burns." She waved her hands in the air. "Guess I made a mistake," said Jean. "I thought you were someone I knew from Woodlawn." Seneca smiled. "That's okay. Everybody makes mistakes." The friend said, "It's fine now, look." Seneca and Jean both looked. Her hands were clean, no blood, just a few lines that might or might not leave marks. "Great. Let's go." "Well, bye." "Jean, bye." Gunning the gas pedal while watching his rearview mirror, Jack said, "Who was that?" "Some girl I thought I knew from before, when I lived in those apartments on Woodlawn, the housing project there." "What housing project?" "On Woodlawn." "Never any projects on Woodlawn," said Jack. "That was Beacon, torn down now, but it was never on Woodlawn. Beacon is where it was, right next to the old playground." "You sure about that?" "Sure, I'm sure. You losing it, woman." In ocean hush, a woman black as firewood is singing. Next to her is a younger woman whose head rests on the singing woman's lap. Ruined fingers troll the tea-brown hair. All the colors of seashells, wheat, roses, pearl, fuse in the younger woman's face. Her emerald eyes adore the black face framed in cerulean blue. Around them on the beach, sea trash gleams. Discarded bottle caps sparkle near a broken sandal. A small dead radio plays the quiet surf. There's nothing to beat this solace, which is what Piedad's song is about, although the words evoke memories neither one has ever had, of reaching age in the company of the other, of speech shared and divided bread, smoking from the fire, the unambivalent bliss of going home to be at home, the ease of coming back to love begun. When the ocean heaves, sending rhythms of water ashore, Piedad looks to see what has come. Another ship, perhaps, but different, heading to port, crew and passengers lost and saved, a tremble, for they have been disconsolate for some time. Now they will rest before shouldering the endless work they were created to do down here in paradise.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Paradise, read for you by the author, Toni Morrison. This program was directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 1997-2014 by Toni Morrison. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.